Hello, welcome to the HSJ Health Check Podcast. I'm your host, Annabelle Collins, and this week I'm joined by Alison Moore and Emily Townsend. On this episode, we're talking about maternity care quality in the NHS, including an HSJ investigation into delayed inductions of labour, the variation in how serious maternity incidents are reported across different trusts, and more about the challenges facing maternity services in England and what is being done to improve them. But let's start with the investigation I mentioned first. And Alison, this was your piece. As I said, you looked in detail about delayed inductions of labour. Perhaps we could start with what first interested you in looking at this in more detail.
Thanks, Annabelle. Well, last year I did a story about the CQC picking up on delayed inductions of labour in some of their reports on maternity units. And it was obvious there was a problem there. So I decided it was probably worth looking in a little bit more depth. It's been quite difficult to do because there doesn't seem to be any general agreement about what a delay is and where it occurs in the process. It can occur at several points. It can be someone who rings in from home and then needs an induction, and they're given a time to come in, and the induction is then delayed from that time of admission. But it might be also someone who the doctors or midwives have decided actually does need induction, but maybe they can't be fitted in because the unit is incredibly busy. So they might actually be at home for several days before they come in. And I think there can also be delays in the progression of induction once it's started, which is obviously undesirable to let go on for too long.
And in the piece, you reported that there were thousands of safety reports raised or kind of red flags. I wonder, could you kind of explain what a red flag event is?
Yes, I mean, this is a very specific one, which NICE introduced in 2015. A maternity red flag event covers a number of things, but one of the criteria for them is a delayed induction of labour of more than 2 hours from admission. And that is one of the things that really trusts should be collecting details on. I did look at other measures, but there didn't seem to be any uniformity around what trusts measured and didn't measure. And the whole point of these red flags is that they should make a maternity unit have a look at its staffing at that point. So if you've got a number of red flags coming up, either for induction of labour or for one of the other areas that they're meant to be used for, then the midwife in charge should be saying, well, do I actually have enough midwives on duty, or should we try and get someone else in?
So going back to the piece, so what data did you collect? Was it an FOI kind of based piece? And what did you find out?
It was indeed. We sent out FOI inquiries to about 120 trusts in England that had maternity units. The two things I was really looking for was the evidence of these NICE defined red flags involving induction of labour, and also DATICs or equivalent alerts that mentioned induction of labour, not necessarily a delay, but a problem with induction of labour. And what I found was that there had been a significant increase in 2022 to 2023 compared with the two earlier years in both red flags and DATEX reports on induction of labour. Quite significant increase, partly explained by one or two trusts reporting large numbers in 22 to 23 who hadn't reported them in previous years. But I think what came out of that was a feeling that maybe these systems aren't being used uniformly around the country, and some trusts just don't seem to be reporting red flags at all. Others had extreme difficulty in getting me the information. Some were saying, well, you know, we have it, but it's going to take more than 18 hours of work, which is the limit under the FOI Act, for us to get it to you, and therefore we can't give it to you. And as I said, certainly with red flags, some trusts just weren't recording them.
That's interesting. So actually, in reality, the overall figure could be a lot higher.
Oh, I think it probably is because we did get partial responses. Inevitably, there were trusts that didn't respond at all, and there were trusts that couldn't respond to all our questions. So I would have thought, with adequate reporting of both red flags and datex across all trusts, the figures would be very significantly higher.
When we're talking about high figures, what sort of numbers were coming back?
Well, in 2022 to 23, one trust, Leeds Teaching Hospitals Trust, had 889 reports of induction of labour red flags. Now, that's a trust which I think is actually rated good for maternity care. So it may well be that they have quite a good reporting culture, and it may well be that each of those red flags then led to a reassessment of the staffing in the unit, and perhaps they brought in more midwives or whatever. So I wouldn't want to completely blame say that Leeds was a poor performer based on that. It may just be a good reporter. For Datex, we had in one case over 300 reports involving induction of labour, and that was County Durham and Darlington, which I think does have one or two problems around its maternity services.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point to make, isn't it? That and this is often the thing, in reporting cultures, if there are a lot of Datex reports, then it could mean that actually there's a really good open culture, not necessarily that an organisation is less safe than another trust. Did you get a sense of kind of which way round it was with this particular investigation? Or I mean, it can be really hard to tell, I know.
Yes, I think it is hard to tell. There were trusts where I know that there have been question marks over the maternity services, which did have a lot of good red flags coming up. So it may not entirely be due to good reporting cultures, or it may be very, very variable between trusts, because I think this is probably a cultural issue in trusts about how willing you are to put your hand up and say, we're in problems here. We don't have enough midwives. I'm seeing a lot of women delayed before their induction is started, which may not be particularly serious. It may be that they're just sitting there in a bed waiting for the whole thing to go. But it can't. We do know that delays in induction of labour in certain circumstances are really very, very worrying. There's a increased risk of harm to mothers and babies. That's particularly true after 41 weeks of pregnancy, where NICE a few years back said that you should certainly consider induction at that point. It used to be 42, because of the increased risk of harm. So it is always a little difficult with this sort of investigation to be quite certain about what is going on the ground. Are we actually seeing harm caused to women and babies, or are we perhaps seeing in some of those cases just a bit of inconvenience, really? But the fact that we're seeing more of this year on year does suggest that something's going on.
Yeah, I think, yeah, it's interesting. And did you get a sense of what is causing the delays in inductions? You've mentioned midwife staff shortages, and we'll come on to that in more detail, as that's something that's raised over and over again by the CQC. But is there anything else that you think are causing these delays?
Well, I guess it could be organisation within the trusts when women are invited in for an induction, whether they're all told to come in at 9 a.m. in the morning, and actually there is not the capacity to start the inductions at 9:30, and consequently some of them end up being induced in the afternoon and so forth. But I do suspect that midwifery staffing is probably the main component. More generally, on delays to induction of labour, rather than those just seen between admission and start, which is what the red flags measure, there's obviously an issue of whether women are being adequately risk assessed and brought in as appropriate to start induction, or whether, hopefully not in many trusts, things are not done as well as that, and women are waiting for quite a long time because, say, the doctor or the midwife has not actually assessed them and made a decision on how quickly the induction needs to happen.
Okay, thanks, Alison. I think that's potentially a good point to can widen this discussion out, as maternity has very much remained in the spotlight over recent months and years. Actually, it feels like there's been a real focus on it, and investment, and it's kind of cut through to the national media as well. I think there was another story last week in The Guardian, and from looking at the CQC data, there is an increasing number of maternity services rated inadequate or requires improvement, and fewer rated good. And there's definite pressure under NHS leaders to make improvements. So, bringing in you, Emily, you cover safety for HSJ, and it was always something that struck me when covering this beat, which is how many different measures there are and recommendations there are for trusts to follow when it comes to improving maternity care. We'll come on to this, but two different reviews by Donna Rockenden, the CQC standards, and much more. My first question to you, really, about all this is, has it become too complicated? Do trusts know exactly what they're meant to be doing to improve standards in maternity care?
Thanks, Annabelle. Yeah, we did a piece a little bit before Christmas about this, echoing some concerns from trust boards, sort of chairs and CEOs telling us that they felt very kind of confused and there isn't a clear national approach to this. So, as you mentioned, you've got the 10 standards set by NHS resolution, you've got CQC, you've got Ockenden and having to self-assess against those standards. So you have so many different things that trusts have to adhere to. And we had Cathy Thompson, who was the outgoing CEO of Liverpool Women's, and she was, questioning how clear trust leaders really are on the national ask, whether it was the 10 standards set by NHS Res, which is financially incentivized, or CQC. And there was also quite a bit of disconnect between the standards. So CQC was very heavy on one side, and NHS resolution is very heavy on others. So there was a lot of kind of disconnect between the standards as well. And there was also some criticism of the effectiveness of the maternity safety support program by NHSE. There was lots of concern echoed by people, and I think that's it was a really kind of strong message really to government and to NHSE, just to say, look, we really don't know what we're doing here. We're, there's so many different things that we have to, it's almost like a massive checklist that we have to tick. And actually, we don't know whether any of these things are improving safety for women and babies. So there was a real concern there. And I do think that that is something that is really kind of coming into the narrative now, because you have lots and lots standards for leaders to adhere to. But I think, I guess it sort of brings me on to some of the other problems sort of nationally, really. You've got, well, there was a report recently which was it was done by the Health and Social Care Committee, which kind of there's obviously been various reviews, national reviews from Morecambe Bay, from East Kent, as Alison did a story on recently. There's lots of those reviews, and the Health and Social Care Committee, the expert panel, essentially rated the government's progress on implementing some of these re recommendations. And I think maternity kind of care and leadership, there was a couple of recommendations that they kind of judged them on. And as we've seen with leaders being really concerned by this, you've got a really kind of strong culture problem, and the culture and like sort of improper person test, and kind of the I think one of the big things is making sure that there's kind of a common code of ethics, standards, and conduct for board leaders, which was from the MidSAFS inquiry. And essentially, there's some concern there about whether that actually improves maternity safety, because that's obviously quite a broad framework. And one of the things that the panel picked up on was that the framework kind of describes some competencies, but it doesn't especially include kind of ethical judgments that board members have to make. So, for instance, exercising their kind of independent judgment on balancing costs with patient safety. So there's various things that, particularly with maternity, you have to make sure that you're kind of, yes, you've got staffing problems, and you have to prioritize the financial issues that you have in the trust. But there's definitely more emphasis, there should be more emphasis on board members to make those kind of judgment, specific judgments on patient safety with maternity. And I think that was one of the big things that came through on that. And there's a lot of discussion over especially with Letby, and you know, having that kind of ethics for board members and ensuring that, you know, maternity is safe, and sort of making sure that board members are really aware of those key problems.
That's interesting. Did they make any recommendations, kind of, I suppose, more around the maternity workforce and what needs to be done kind of in departments in terms of improving safety? Or was it, did they take a more kind of overarching look at maternity leadership within trusts?
Yeah, so they weren't really looking at the kind of staffing problems, I think, probably because it's something that is that is very much kind of on the funding side and making sure that there's enough money to ensure that there's adequate staffing. So they didn't really investigate that. They were very much looking at the kind of maternity care and leadership side of things. So there was also a concern which is kind of goes into the theme of Alison's story on East Kent, which was about investigating deaths. So obviously part of the standards for NHS resolution is about ensuring that perinatal deaths are investigated properly, and this is something that's a really big theme across kind of national coverage. Yeah, quite rightly, and in the inquiries, the various inquiries that are going on. But one of the recommendations they picked up on was, you know, implementing a mechanism to scrutinise perinatal deaths and maternal deaths independently. So that was from Morecambe Bay, which found the inquiry found that the hospital didn't always investigate maternal deaths properly. And the Health and Social Care Committee in this new report kind of criticised the fact that coroners still can't investigate stillbirths. There was a big government consultation that went out in 2019 that still hasn't been responded to by the government. And essentially, there is this new legislation that means that medical examiners can kind of, they can scrutinise all non-coronial deaths. So that will also include perinatal deaths, but there is not a specific kind of investigation into stillbirths, which is obviously a really key part of a lot of these inquiries, is that lots of women have lost their babies, through medical negligence, and you know, it's very bad that this still can't be done. So the Health and Social Care Committee panel was very kind of heavily criticizing that and saying that the government progress on this has not kind of gone far enough. So that's another kind of element about the deaf side of things, that you know, even though there's all these standards, even though there's all these kind of various checks and balances on trusts, there's still not that kind of adequate independent scrutiny of deaths. And I think that was a kind of a big theme that came through there.
Has there been resistance to enabling coroners to investigate stillbirths? Or is it just, I don't know, it's a complicated thing and it's taking time to implement. Is there anything more specific going on there?
I think a lot of it is to do with, I think it came in before the pandemic. So I think a lot of it is to do with pandemic delays. That's what's been sort of cited by ministers. So it seems as if it's more a kind of, it's a complicated issue, as you mentioned, and it's taking time to go through it. However, the panel was quite heavily critical of the fact that it has taken such a long time, because something like this, having stillbirths investigated independently, is a really kind of key thing. And they were quite concerned that that hasn't been responded to yet, given that it was sort of 5 years ago now that this was put out. So I think there is concern over that. There wasn't a specific kind of reason given by the Department of Health, but it just seems as if there's been a general delay.
Okay. And I also kind of wanted to bring up the CQC. And I think we've all noticed over the last while, I think they started their focused maternity inspections at the end of 2021, I think. We've seen an increasing number of reports coming back on maternity services with them rated inadequate services. I think there was one in Sheffield that springs to mind that was good, and it dropped two ratings, which is really significant. And I'd be interested in your thoughts, Emily, on whether they're now looking for thing and they found a deterioration in care quality, which is obviously, you know, really important to shine a light on. Or is it that I don't know, some are saying that they're being kind of unfair perhaps, and some trusts have been quite critical, as you've described with the Liverpool story, about all the different things they're meant to be doing that are unclear what standards they're meant to be meeting. Kind of, I wonder which way you think it falls.
So I think the program itself, I think obviously it's going to, it's a targeted program which is looking at all maternity units in the country. And I think when you've got something like that, I think trusts are aware that it's going to happen, that their unit will be inspected soon. And I think that there's a degree of, there is more scrutiny on these units, therefore maybe more problems are being uncovered. Perhaps I think in the past it's been that there may be adverse media coverage, or there's been sort of whistleblower concerns that have been raised with the CQC and then they've gone to inspect, whereas this is kind of a dedicated program. And I think that there's kind of, they're looking for the same themes, they're looking for they're kind of, they've got a maybe a bit more specific criteria that they're looking at. So I think that there's a something to be said about the fact that there's perhaps naturally more scrutiny falling on these units. But there was something that I saw last night actually, which is by ITV Central, which was a whistleblower that had spoken to them. It was a midwife that essentially said that when, you know, they felt that actually when the CQC comes in, that people almost put on a circus show. So it's that they know that they're going to be inspected, they know that there's going to be scrutiny on their service, so they kind of put on their best behaviour, and actually the day-to-day problems are a lot worse. And I think that there is something to be said about that, that they know that their maternity is under a lot of scrutiny. But I also feel that from that story that we did last year, and just in general, the kind of general national kind of narrative is that essentially, you know, that there's some real concern on the ground about this, but I'm not sure how it kind of filters through to board. So there was an interesting comment in this, in the story that we put together from a director, which essentially said that NEDs, sort of non-executive directors, will often jump to kind of asking for more investment. So it's always about, oh, we need some more money to ensure that we've got more staffing. And obviously that is often quite a good argument, but essentially they're saying that they're very quick to jump to almost being like trade union reps, they describe them as, but actually they're not holding the executive team to account. So they're not, you know, they're not properly scrutinizing the board and these safety reports that come through. They're almost just saying, they're using it as kind of a to pass it off essentially and say, oh well, we need more extra investment. And because they know where they won't necessarily get it, it's like, oh okay, if, you know, and they're not really doing their jobs properly essentially. That's what they're saying. And I think it's complicated by the fact that you've got so many reports, you've got so many, I don't know about you, Alison and Annabelle, but when I'm looking through board reports, the sheer amount of maternity kind of standards and reporting that trusts have to do is it's so complex. And I think when you have people on boards that don't necessarily have that clinical experience, and I think it's very easy for people, so you see it variation, I think, because some non-executive directors are great and they're, you know, they're very kind of good at scrutinizing board performance and kind of, you know, safety. But there are others that are very sort of happy to be told that things are going right. Especially you've seen that with Shrewsbury and Telford, that it was very much like they were kind of pacified almost by the board saying, oh, it's all okay. And actually, it really wasn't. They weren't asking the right questions, and I think that's a concern for board members in general.
I think that's really true, Emily. I think it's only a minority of non-executives at the boards I watch who actually challenge appropriately and have the knowledge and the impetus to dig very deeply. But having said that, I do feel a little bit of sympathy for trusts at the moment on the whole issues around maternity. I think the CQC has started picking up on things which perhaps hadn't featured before. And it's very easy for a trust then to be caught out. One of my local trusts, Maidstone in Tunbridge Wells, was its main maternity unit was rated inadequate recently, which I think was probably quite a shock to the trust management. And one of the things they picked up on was the availability or non-availability of a second obstetric theatre throughout the night. So if you've got one emergency, it's likely to go into that first obstetric theatre. What happens when you have a second emergency? Do you have both the staff and the availability of theatre to get in at really short notice? Because I think if you're talking about emergency cesareans, we are in the area where minutes count. And with many trusts, the obstetric theatres are not necessarily close to the main theatres. So even if you can access a main theatre. It may be some minutes away. Plus, of course, you have to get it opened up and a team in there ready to go. So that's not something I've seen in the CQC report before, but I have noticed it's now started to come up on one or two other board agendas where trusts are acknowledging they probably don't meet this requirement. And I wonder if that's something where we might see some investment called for in the next year or so. Quite tough to do, I feel. And I think some trusts are perhaps being pragmatic, saying, well, what's the risk of having two obstetric emergencies at the same time and not being able to wheel one across to the main theatre complex against the cost of potentially investing in more theatres and also investing in the staff to open them up. But having said that, of course, cases which go wrong, particularly if a baby survives but is brain damaged, you're talking about millions in compensation these days, possibly even into the tens of millions. Difficult one for trust management, I feel. And obviously, what we're seeing is quite a focus on maternity in many trust boards. I do wonder, particularly in some of the trusts which have had very high profile issues with maternity, whether that can sometimes mean that other areas of the trust don't get the examination they require.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I think I'd agree with you, Emily, that maternity does take up a lot of trust boards. I mean, possibly rightly so, but it's hard to tell, isn't it, whether it's taking oxygen from other areas that could also do with investment and scrutiny. I wanted to pick up on that question of investment, actually. I think it was when Jeremy Hunt was chair of the Health Select Committee. Is that right? When he the Select Committee recommended an investment of between 200 and 350 million into maternity services. So has that been forthcoming now? Jeremy Hunt is Chancellor.
In short, no. I think the Department of Health would probably say, that they have said that from April this year they're investing 186 million a year, which obviously is at the lower end of that recommendation by Jeremy Hunt. So I think I interviewed Donna Ockenden before Christmas about this specific thing, because obviously he's in a position now where he was calling for something and is now in a position to be funding it, and there's obviously this gap there. And I think, there was in the recent budget, there was a £35 million pound investment announced for maternity, which Royal College of Midwives and kind of said that will help fund 160 new midwife posts. But Donna, when we were speaking to her, is saying that this investment is nowhere, well, not that investment specifically, the investment overall is nowhere near good enough. So it's been around kind of 100, 150, and it's now going up to 186 a year, which obviously she's not dismissing the fact that there is obviously quite a lot of investment there, but clearly to satisfy the recommendations from her report, I think it was actually announced after either her first or second report into Sarojini and Tilford failings. Essentially, he was saying that amount of money is required to improve maternity services and improve safety. And obviously, that money has not been, that the kind of total amount of money has not been forthcoming. And I think that's a real concern, particularly for Donna, because she's looking, as you, as we've mentioned with Nottingham, she's about to kind of. She's going to be reporting perhaps at the end of the year, perhaps early next year, about the kind of biggest maternity inquiry in England, with, potentially thousands of women and babies that she's looking at in terms of harm. And you've got a chancellor who is sitting in the chair now with the ability to give some of this investment that he said he himself said is needed to improve safety in England. And it's just not. It's not enough, as she was saying, and she's really concerned. She's a really kind of key voice on this, understandably, because her reports have informed, major changes across the country. And I think there is a real concern there. Obviously, it's always good that there is some money, but it's just not enough. And I think that's the narrative that's coming across. And there is still this concern, even though there's this 35 million, it's like, well, if you've got 160 new midwives, but a lot of the concern in terms of midwifery is that you have lots of midwives retiring and they've got a wealth of experience, they've got lots of lessons that they can, lots of knowledge that they can kind of impart on trainees and people coming in, and you have lots of those people retiring and leaving, and you don't replace like for like. And while it's always good to have new midwives, it's you've got that kind of depth of experience, and I think that's a real concern as well, particularly from the Royal College of Midwives, that they're concerned that there is this sort of knowledge gap, and that's where you get issues with when you have red flags. You've got kind of newly trained midwives who are really trying to, really, really working hard, but you've got this lack of experience. And I think there's a concern there as well. So it's a really tricky one.
Yeah, I think that point about experience is really important. I think that's a problem across the NHS, a lack of trainers and losing experienced staff who decide to retire early for whatever reason, pensions and pressure and those sorts of things. It's not talked about that much, I think, because it's not super exciting to talk about supervision and training, but it's so important. And as well as, I suppose, investing in staff, there's kind of the less tangible bit about maternity improvements in terms of culture. And that's been a massive bit of the conversation, I think, particularly in the Ockenden inquiries, the Kirkup inquiry in East Kent as well. I'm sure you'd agree, Alison, about...
Yes, for culture was and is still, I feel, a massive issue in East Kent. And also morale. The Trust did very poorly in the staff survey this year. It may have technically improved on last year, but it was bottom of all acute trusts on all comparative trusts on a number of areas. And I think morale in their maternity units must be pretty low.
Yeah, I think the impact of these big reports shouldn't be underestimated. I think as well on the staff, but also on the public as well. I think I feel that there's a loss of kind of public confidence, perhaps, because it doesn't go unnoticed when these things are reported.
No.
And they cut through to the national media in this way.
Yes, and frankly, there should be a loss of public confidence in some of these units.
Yeah.
I think Shrewsbury and Telford has had a really kind of uphill struggle to try and win back the trust of their community. When I interviewed Louise Barnett, I think it must have been a year and a half ago now, she was really kind of concerned about the fact that they've really lost the public's trust. But obviously there have been issues, that there's been two kind of big inquiries, and that there are still issues being reported now while she's been in charge. So I think there are, it is very difficult, and I think it's an uphill battle, and I think they still have so far to go to win that public confidence, and that there are still failings happening. So I think there's real kind of questions to be answered there.
I think East Kent probably has improved in its maternity services since the Kirkup inquiry reported, which was 18 months ago now. They're certainly trying very hard. The board is very engaged in that area. And there are some signs of change, which is very encouraging.
Shall we just end on the East Kent story you did this week, Alison, about it kind of links to what we've been talking about around maternity inquiries, but actually what happens next, I suppose, and what perhaps the expectations of families involved isn't met.
Yes, I mean, I think this is actually a very, very sad story I wrote, which seems to have made quite a lot of people quite angry. Basically, the families, many of the families whose cases were looked at in the Kirkup inquiry, and care was found to be significantly lacking in the judgment of the expert clinicians that were involved in that, have then obviously had a case for some level of compensation, either for the harm caused to women or for the death of babies. So the compensation in the death of babies is actually relatively small, often only around 15,000, I understand. But some of the women suffered real harm. In some cases, there were babies that were left with brain damage and so forth. So it's not really surprising that families should be looking for some recompense for that, because in some cases they will have a lifetime of looking after a severely disabled child as a result. However, despite everything that was done to make what I'm told was a very robust clinical judgment on the individual cases, NHS Resolution, which obviously deals with clinical negligence cases for the whole of the NHS, is insisting that the families effectively start from ground zero and prove liability, which means in many cases they are still fighting for any level of compensation, and this can relate to cases that are perhaps 8 to 10 years old. They are having to go through the gamut of employing lawyers, employing specialist or expert midwives to give their opinion, expert obstetric doctors, neonatologists, and so forth. And in some cases, the women involved are having to have very grueling psychological assessments. So it's pretty awful to have to go through that. Obviously pretty expensive as well, if you end up having to bear the costs of the lawyers and the experts and so forth. But there seems to be no willingness to move to a better position or to accept the judgments that were made by Bill Kirkup's team. Dr. Kirkup himself is, he was a very measured man, not given to hyperbole, is called for a more passionate, a compassionate approach to these families, and stress the robust nature of the determinations which were made in these cases.
So who has the power to change the approach with the families?
I think the government has. I think the government could overrule this and just say, right, in these terrible cases, we're not going to make the families go through the horror, frankly, of having to go through all of this process again, to talk about what was obviously horrible experiences for many of them. We're just going to pay up. And I have asked the Department of Health and Social Care about this and not really got a very encouraging answer.
You're right, it's really sad after going through such a, you know, a huge inquiry and all the trauma to have to go through another thing.
I'm told there's families who are traumatised and don't want to re-engage with this process because they just can't face going through and reliving everything again.
And this could, I suppose, correct me if I'm wrong, be the case after the Nottingham inquiry, well, independent review we mentioned, because it's not a statutory inquiry. So
yes,
they could have to also go through this.
I understand things might be different if it's a statutory inquiry, and there could be some level of compensation received automatically without having to go through the proving legal liability issue that the families in East Kent happen to go through.
We've seen we've seen that with the post office and the infected bloods, though. But you've got major statutory inquiries that you're still waiting on compensation.
Yeah.
So while there is the government, they acknowledge that they need to, it could be another, several years wait, or obviously that a lot of it is being pushed to after the election. But clearly you can see from big inquiries like that, that sometimes it's an even longer wait and even more compounded trauma. So it is concerning.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I mean, it does seem slightly odd, because in the David Fuller case at Maidstone in Tunbridge Wells, which involved a electrical supervisor who violated women's bodies in the hospital morgue, which was obviously just incredibly distressing for the families when they found out what had happened. There was an almost automatic payout to family members, I understand, of several thousand pounds. And they didn't have to take any court action or anything like that to receive it. So it seems slightly odd that in these really horrible cases of maternity failing, a similar approach can't be adopted.
It sounds like it's potentially within their power, as you said, Alison, the government's power to make that decision.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, well, thanks both very much. I think we'd better wrap up this week. But thanks so much for joining me. And just to listeners, don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back next week.